comes from the creative writing side, and I come from military history side. We have very different ways of doing things. I recognized a long time ago I was not suitable to be a fiction writer for whatever reasons. And he is. He can write 11,000 words to finish off a novel in one day. Like, that's amazing. So you have to recognize what your strong points are and what they're not. And sometimes people are unfortunate. There's a Swedish composer, Franz Berwald, who wanted to be an opera composer, and he wrote operas and he wrote symphonies, and the only thing he's remembered for is his symphonies. But he wanted to be an opera composer. Oh well. That kind of thing happens to people. The lucky people are the ones who know what they want to do from a young age, and they do it. But not everybody's like that. The first thing you have to decide about a game, I believe, is who is the audience? Who are you doing this game for? Who's going to play this game? Because once you figure that out, you have some idea what sort of game you want to do. Now, different people approach this in different ways, and a game might just come to you. And then you worry about the audience later. But if you sit down and say, I'm going to make a game, then one of the first questions to ask is, who is the audience for this game? And going back to that art and science, because a lot of this is perspiration rather than inspiration, if you're going to be a designer, you need to sit down and say, I'm going to make a game. What am I going to do? You don't wait for it to flow through the ether and come in through your ears, because it may happen sometimes, especially in the shower, but a lot of times it's not going to happen. You've got to make it happen. You gotta decide, I am going to make a game. What's it gonna be? Who's gonna be the audience? What's it gonna be about? Let me write this down. It's always important to write things down. If you don't write it down, unless you have an elephantine memory, you're gonna forget. If you write it down, then you may read it a year later and it'll give you inspiration for something else. I made games where I started years ago and didn't get very far, and then more recently ran across the notes and so on and said, if I modify this way and this way, then that's something interesting, I'm going to work on it. If I hadn't written it down, poof. And as I showed in the other ones, I have this notebook that I carry around with me. And then I transfer that stuff to computer because I might lose that notebook. And I have this PDA, Star Trek style, and I can talk to it and then transfer those notes to a desktop, transfer to a desktop at work. I already got 3 copies then. I hate the idea of losing things. And you know, if you use a computer very long, you're going to have a hard drive die on you. It's happened 3 times to me. So you need backups. You make those notes, and then you've got something. If you don't make those notes, you've got nothing. And this is especially difficult for young people to swallow because they don't want to write anything down. But you have to choose. Do you want to continue to have the fruits of your labor, or do you want it to have it go away? You can have an idea and you'll never have it again. That's what I think. You better write it down. So who is the audience? There is no perfect game. Britannia is a very long game. A lot of people don't care for long games. Other people have played it 500 times. A game that's 4 or 5 hours. Pretty amazing to me. I haven't played it 500 times. Any game that you can name, some people will like and some people won't. If you're lucky, you'll make a game that a lot of people will like. Settlers of Catan, a lot of people like. I read the rules, I said, oh, that's nice. I don't want to play. Why would I bother? A lot of people like poker. A lot of people don't. 20 years ago, a lot fewer people liked poker. Maybe that's because now we have Texas Hold'em instead of 5-card draw. It's a different version of poker. Who knows? The point, again, is there's no perfect game. And you may be able to make a game that 5 people will like, but that's not commercially viable. You may be able to make a game that 1,000 people like, And there may be publishers who are willing to publish 1,000 copies of it. Usually a war game, a monster war game, something like that. If you can make a game that 10,000 people will like, then you're more likely to find a publisher to publish it. I'm not sure there's any such thing as a game that a million people will like. You know, a million people like Settlers of Catan, but that's partly chance. Collectible card games, Magic the Gathering, maybe that's one where Richard Garfield made a game that a million people would like. And he finally found a publisher. I don't know how long it took him. I mean, he may have not had much trouble with it. And it worked. But you don't know. You can say things like, if it's a long game, it's not going to appeal to a lot of people nowadays. Very much people are interested in shorter games. It's the PlayStation generation, the TV generation, the internet generation. Things are short and sweet and simple, and that's how you reach a mass market. Do you want to reach a mass market? That's part of your decision about an audience. Can you decide to make a mass market game? If you like mass market games, yes. I do not like mass market games generally, so I do not decide to make a mass market game. Unfortunately, that's not going to make as much money as a mass market game would. Oh well. At some point, you can ask yourself, should I try to design a game that I don't like? I think that's a bad idea. People do it. Well, I see that this is so popular, I'm going to design a game just like that. I think it's a bad idea. And when they do, they usually get something that's so derivative of that other game that nobody wants to have anything to do with it. The umpteenth version of Monopoly, you know? That's what the manufacturers are worried about, that somebody will come to them with umpteenth version of Monopoly, slightly modified. They don't want anything to do with that. Monopoly's not that good a game. It's in the culture, but it's not a very good game. If it were published today, it probably wouldn't do very well. That seems to be a general opinion. Who knows whether it's true? So, you decide your audience, and at some point you have to ask yourself, what makes a game good? Now, if we ask people that, we'd get a lot of different opinions here. And if people thought about it, they might change their opinions too. If you read a book about game design, a video game design, for example, then sometimes you will get opinions. In fact, there's a game called The Theory of Fun in Game Design, a book called Theory of Fun in Game Design, which is evidently very good. I have not read it. Fun is very a hard term to define. The games that I like, it's not the game so much that's fun. The game is interesting, and it's fun because of the people you play with. But there are a lot of different versions of it. Games can have educational value. Since our last seminar, I talked until 15 minutes before this one started with somebody. We talked about educational games and what could be done. It's a different kind of market. We're trying to get to where you can have an educational game that the teachers can deal with. It's also fun to play. Ooh, that's tough. Some people, when they play a game, they want laughs. Some people want strategy. Two very different things. Family games are fun for family people. Strategy games are fun for strategy people. You know, is chess fun for people who like chess? I'd say it's interesting rather than fun, but you know, you can mince words. Games tend to be social occasions, but not everybody plays it that way. Chess isn't necessarily social. Two people, and they might not even know each other. They're just playing a chess game. So you can say a game is good because it's fun, but that's not it. It depends again on your audience. So you have to figure out, what is it that your audience wants? Does your audience want a short game that's a take that game where you play something and it changes the game a lot? That's very different from chess. Very different even from checkers or draughts. What are you looking for? Some people play to win. Some people are the sharks, I call them, the really good players. They don't like to play a game where they can be gypped, where somebody who's not as good a player can beat them. Although when you play a multiplayer game, more than two players, that can happen. You can be the best player, and if they gang up on you, there's not anything you can do. You're gone. There are romantic players and classical players. The classical players want to know all the possibilities, and they figure everything out, and they try to make the best move. The romantic players look for the big surprise move that'll really take out the enemy, really psych them out. And some people play that way. Well, the romantic players like event cards in a game, for example. Classical players don't like them because they're hard to control. But the event cards can do that. Wow, what a surprise move that the romantic players like. So, who are you making your game for? There are many, many, many points of view. And at some point, you have to decide these things. Now, you might make a game and find out that it's not what you expected by the time you get done, but still, there are decisions made. Sometimes there are decisions that are made by default. You don't really think about it and it happens. There are lots of genres, and genres are very easy to define in video games. There's first-person shooters, there's action games, there's real-time strategy games, there's turn-based strategy games, there's role-playing games, and so forth. In non-digital games, we have collectible card games, we have non-collectible card games, we have role-playing games, we have board games, and we have miniatures. And that's about it. But within those, there's a lot more variation than there is in video games. First-person shooter is a pretty clear thing in a video game. So, you might need to think about what genre you're interested in, but certainly whether you're going to make a card game or whatever. We were talking about educational games, as I said, and the person I was talking to had been thinking in terms of board games, and I said, that's not going to work. You need to have a card game. Why? Because you need a really simple game, and the rules have to be really short, so you put the rules on the cards. That's one of the things that makes collectible card games so popular. The rules are on the cards, and you only have to learn them when you read the cards. That simplifies things a great deal. It's one of the reasons why they attract younger people. Card games also tend to be shorter, which is important if you're in a classroom. So she was, I think, barking up the wrong whatever it is. I forget what the end of that term is. Barking up the wrong
tree.
Barking up the wrong tree. Thank you. My dogs only barked up trees when there were squirrels in them. So genre is important, and it makes a difference into how the game works. Collectible card games, for example, are not so much good on their own as they're good because of the metagame, the larger game that's around it. You don't want it to be balanced. You want there to be a clear deck that is the best deck. And then you change the rules, and next year it's a different deck that's the best deck. Board games are different. You want it to be properly balanced to start with. You're not going to add to it. So, two completely different objectives, really. Of course, collectible card games are a problem. You need $1 million to get a collectible card game going. So, you probably shouldn't even think about designing a collectible card game unless you have a contract from somebody to do it. Because you can approach a manufacturer and they'll just laugh at you. We don't have $1 million to do that. And if we did, we'd do it with a particular property that we know about. So there are limitations of that sort too. Now, I talked some in the other seminars about this, but since a lot of people were not at those, I will speak about it again. I believe that the more you limit yourself, the more creative you'll get. If you can't decide the answers to questions like the ones I've been posing and a lot of others, then how are you going to get anywhere? How are you going to know where to go? And my reading of history is that in eras where there were particular rules about how art was supposed to be done, you got great art. Frequently the people would break the rules, like Beethoven breaking the rules sometimes, but mostly staying within the rules. In eras where there were not clear rules, like nowadays with art, painting, you get a bunch of junk. Or at least you don't get great stuff, you get okay stuff. So I think imposing some limits on yourself, in effect, makes you more creative and maybe makes you do better what you're trying to do. And you may at some point decide to break one of those limits, which you're perfectly free to do, as long as you're designing a game on spec. Now, if you're designing a game on contract to somebody that's supposed to fit in with a particular tie-in, you've already got a set of limits. If you're designing a game about Pirates of the Caribbean, it's going to be a Pirates game and it's going to have certain characters in it and so on and so forth. By the way, you would never want to do that unless you already have a contract, because it's almost impossible to take a game that relies on somebody else's intellectual property and persuade somebody to publish it, because they probably don't have that intellectual property. If they do, they probably have their own ideas about what they want to do with it because they paid a lot of money for it. So you could design a game about Pirates of the Caribbean, but whoever has the Pirates of the Caribbean rights is probably not going to be interested. Unless maybe you're a really famous designer, maybe. Now, there are publisher-imposed limits as well. Some publishers, for example, do not publish games that have three-dimensional bits. War game publishers tend to publish games with cardboard counters. So if you come to them with a game that needs lots of 3D bits, no matter how much they like it, they can't publish it. Now, most of you know the German companies have a much larger market for Euro-style games, and consequently, they often do the bits, and the bits are a little bit cheaper there than they are here, either German or Polish, I'm not sure, the wooden bits. But then you have a more practical situation. So you have to keep in mind the publisher's limitations. Sometimes they tend to have certain size maps. Well, maps are kind of amorphous, you know, you can make them bigger or smaller. But if you make a game with a map like that, a lot of publishers don't want to have anything to do with it. Especially if they always publish games that are hard mounted, that's really expensive. They're not going to do it. If you want to have a game with a hard mounted map, some companies don't do hard mounted maps. So there are things like that that you have to keep in mind. Every upgrade, you might say, or every level up of how much it's going to cost to produce it limits your market more and more. So do you want to limit your market? You shouldn't limit your market unless you have to. Now, if you get to a point like Matt Forbeck, who companies come to and ask him to do work for him, then you have a lot more freedom. But that's very, very much the exception. So one of the things I have been doing for the past several years is the quest for the one-hour war game, which wouldn't be so bad if it was two players, but I want it to be up to six. I've done four different systems, and I have finally achieved it. It's been played twice by other people, three players, an hour and 20 minutes the first time, a very deliberate player, 51 minutes the second time with three different players. Now, I may add event cards to it as an option because it's a pretty simple game. And the event cards, a lot of people like. Who knows? And then people can play the shorter version, or they can play the slightly longer version with the event cards. But the quest for that one-hour war game made me simplify things, made me think of new ways to do things. It helped improve the games. And fortunately, it's something that publishers are now interested in. Euro war games. Okay. The idea is not the game. I hope we've established that. I pound that into people's heads. And if you never bring another thing from one of these talks that I've done in Matt, is that the idea is nothing. You've got to have a game. And the pyramid of game design is lots of people get ideas. Fewer people try to go from the general idea to the specific game idea, because a lot of people have a general idea, and when you ask them, describe the game to me, they don't know what, they can't tell you. Because they've never put it in the game terms. It's always been this cool idea. You got to put it in the game terms. The next step there is to produce a prototype. Okay, now we've got it in specific game terms. Let's make something we can play. Fewer people do that. Fewer yet produce a decently playable prototype. A lot of prototypes, yeah, you can play it, but it's terrible. Fewer yet produce a complete game with a full set of rules, and then fewer yet produce a good complete game. So there's a pyramid there, and in the slides there's a nice little pyramid. And you want to get to the top of that pyramid if you want to have a commercial game or one that people will enjoy playing, whether you have it published or not. How do you get ideas? They don't just come to you. You have to think about it. You sit down and say, I'm going to do ideas. I'm going to write down ideas about games. They may come to you some, and if it's in the shower, you can't very well write it down, but write it down when you get out of the shower. Or put it in your recorder or whatever. I have a clipboard right next to my bed, so I can write those things down when I get out of the shower and hope that, you know, I don't forget them before I get out of the shower. It's very frustrating to forget an idea. Very frustrating, I think. Because you never know whether it's going to come back. There are lots of places you get ideas from, but the main thing is, if you're looking for ideas, you'll get them. Where do you get ideas from? You get ideas from talking to other people. You get ideas from watching people play games. You get ideas from reading the rules to games. You get ideas from reading reviews of games. You get ideas from reading what people say about games. You get ideas from going online to places like Board Game Geek and Board Game Designers Forum. You get ideas from reading books. You get ideas from watching TV. You get ideas from walking in the park. If you're receptive to ideas, they'll come to you. If you're not receptive, then they won't come to you. So for somebody who does this seriously, and of course it's only a hobby for me, but I'm still serious about it. For somebody who does this seriously, ideas are not a problem. It's getting the time to turn it into something that can be played, and then taking the time to develop it to the point where you got a complete set of rules and you played it enough that you think you've got something. Ideas are... And novelists are the same way. You talk to somebody who's a full-time novelist, they have far more ideas than they can possibly use. So if you're having trouble getting ideas, it's because you're not trying. And you're not opening your mind to the possibilities. Especially nowadays, we have some really strange Euro games that, you know, the themes are bizarre, and I'd say, who the hell would want to play a game like that? But some people do. So almost anything you can talk about can be an idea for a game if you want to work at it. Now, Richard Berg says he can take anything and turn it into a game. Well, I'm not sure about that, but he can certainly make a try at it. When you get the idea, write it down, whether it's in a notebook or on a computer. I use a program called InfoSelect to store this stuff because it's easily retrievable. Microsoft OneNote would be one that you could use. There are others. Some of them are free. You can get free note-taking programs of various sorts. Memento is a very simple one. It's free. If you write things in a notebook and you lose a notebook, you'll be very unhappy. If you're not a computer person, though, that's all you got. If you're a computer person, put it in the computer, make backups, distribute the backup somewhere else. If your house burns down, you still got the ideas, damn it. Heaven forbid your house should burn down, but it happens to people, doesn't it? Or if your hard drive dies, croak, poof, gone. You want backups. It's like religion. You have to be religious about this. I'm going to back this stuff up. You know, I feel slightly antsy because I have stuff in here that I've written in the past few days I haven't put in the computer yet. Keeping my eye on this thing. Because I don't want to have to reproduce that stuff because I won't remember it all. Then you have to make use of ideas, and we've already said there's nothing original. Here's a quote from a movie, oddly enough. Strictly speaking, there's no such thing as invention, you know? It's only magnifying what already exists. There are occasionally new ideas in games, and then you have something like Dungeons & Dragons or Magic the Gathering. That happens once every 20 years or so. You may get an idea like that, but it's very, very unlikely. So don't worry about it. Just try to take existing ideas, existing things, modify them to make them interesting, and go from there. If you try to get the big idea, you'll end up nowhere. I have a slide in here about sources of ideas. It says, other games, history and other nonfiction reading, fiction, people, discussions, everyday things, pictures, almost anything. Okay. Now we have this diagram. And I debated where to put this diagram in these slides, and I've got it here. This is a data flow diagram. And the idea is it's a form of systems analysis where you figure out how a system works. And in actual systems analysis, sometimes then you automate it. Well, in this case, we're not automating it. We're just figuring out how the system works. And this has been modified from comments on BoardGameGeek, which is a very good place to pick other people's brains. At some point, you have to conceive and refine your ideas. That's number one. And you have to store them, though the almost rectangular things are stores, data stores they're called, where you store things. So, you have idea notes somewhere, I hope. And your ideas go into there, and then they go back out where you think about them some more, and ideas generate more ideas. You may have collaborators. You may have people that you'd like to talk to about game design. In some cases, two or three people will design a game together. You bounce those ideas off your collaborators. See what they have to say. That exactly rectangular thing means it's something outside the system. At some point, you're going to have enough of a game in mind that you're going to play it in your mind's eye with thought experiments. That's number two here. And I should have that ideas going both ways there. That's a defect in the diagram. Because the idea notes will help you do your thought experiments. Now, I don't think you're going to play the whole game through in your mind, even if you're very experienced. Reiner Knizia says he does, but I suspect he does the same thing I do, is you put yourself in the position of a player and say, okay, the player's at this point, what does the player see on the board? What do we want the player to feel? What decisions does the player have to make? I think it's very important in a game, and you'll find lots of definitions of games, of course, that the players have interesting challenges to overcome. Some people like to say meaningful. I don't like to use the word meaningful because I don't know what it means. Interesting challenges that you have to overcome. They may not have any meaning other than in the game, but in the game, if it's interesting, okay. If the challenge is not interesting, then why is the person going to bother to play? If it's not a challenge, then so what? So interesting challenges, a series of interesting challenges that people need to get through. That tends to be a game. There's usually an objective involved. If there's not an objective, you've got a toy. You can just play with it, but you never get anywhere. In a game, there's an objective, and then the game is over. Some people would say if there's no opposition, then you have a puzzle. But, you know, you can argue about these things. But you have to think, what can the player do to influence the course of the game? And that's something you can think about before you ever have a game that you play. You may find out, well, gee, there's really nothing for the player to do. Now, how many people here have played some of the Final Fantasy games? Not too many. I have not played Final Fantasy, but I understand that they're very much story-driven, and so you're sort of going along in a story. You have things to do, but it leads you around by the nose. I hate that, but some people love it. So that's one of the things you have to decide when you're doing a game. Is it a story that leads people around by the nose? You can't do that very well in a board game, but you can in a computer game. Dungeons and Dragons. How many people here play Dungeons and Dragons or some RPG? Right. When I played for 29 years, and then 2 years ago I quit. God knows why. I used to write articles for The Dragon, and I was contributing editor of Gamer, White Dwarf, and Dragon, and so on. But I don't do it anymore. Anyway, when I designed an adventure for Dungeons & Dragons, I would set up a situation and then let the players see what they did with it. I didn't have a story in mind. There are other people, when they set up adventures for Dungeons & Dragons, there's a story, and they want the players to go through the story and achieve, you know, get here. Two very different ways of doing it. I know some people who play story-driven RPG that they don't even seem to have rules, but they enjoy it. Sometimes they don't even have a referee, but they seem to enjoy it. But you can't do that very well with a board game or a card game, because board games and card games, by and large, don't have the referee to take care of that thing. You can do it with a computer, or you can do it with a referee. And you have to recognize, of course, if you do a game that requires a referee, you're greatly limiting yourself, but in RPGs, it's the norm. There's really no way around it. You can try to do collaborative games, too, where there's no losers, but that also considerably limits you. But if that's what you want to do, okay. So you play the game in the mind's eye. You're thinking about what the player sees, what the player feels, what you want the player to see and feel, and what decisions can the player make. How can the player control the outcome of the game? Because that's a typical game. Somebody can control the outcome. Again, with party games, it's a lot different from strategy games. I design strategy games. I don't design party games. That's me. Some people like to design party games, but then they're talking about a different kind of game. Still, they're going to play in their mind's eye how that game's going to go. It's just they have different objectives. So at some point, you conceive the game, the structure, and the framework, how the game's actually going to work. And that feeds back to number two. The numbers here don't necessarily mean that it goes in that particular order. It can go back and forth a lot. When you conceive the game structure and so on, if you have collaborators, then you're going to go out and bounce the ideas off of them. So the ideas are flying all over the place. From number three, you're going a couple different ways. Number four is create and refine a prototype. And your ideas about the structure and the framework, which we'll talk about later, go into that. And refinements generate further refinements. You may also have an outline of the game that helps you write down notes about the game. Because you're going to be wanting to write this down. And you may get to the point where you're organizing your notes. Well, this is how we're going to have movement. This is how the sequence of play. This is what pieces we're going to use. So even before you've made the prototype, you can be figuring those things out and writing them down. In fact, you probably can't make a prototype until you've figured those things out. Because when you make a prototype, you've got to know what the pieces are going to be. You've got to know what the board's going to be like. You've got to know roughly what the rules are, or you don't have a playable game. And the objective in the prototype is to get a playable game. Now, you have to store the prototype somewhere, which is that data store down there in the sort of lower left. If you have something physical to make, there are games that don't have anything physical. Most of them have a board, or they have cards, or they have pieces, or something like that. You got to store that somewhere. At some point, then, you will have a playable prototype, and you will want to play it. And I strongly advise that you play it solitaire, because it probably won't work very well. You know, no plan ever survived first contact with the enemy. Well, in this case, the enemy is you actually playing the game. Why inflict that on somebody else? Maybe you have a nice spouse or something like that and you want to suck them in, but I wouldn't. And I met my wife through Dungeons & Dragons. She doesn't play games much anymore. Nonetheless, I try to get to a point before I have other people play where I have a game that I think they'll probably enjoy and it can be played to conclusion. Now, not all designers are like that. Some designers will get play testers and play a while and say, this isn't working, we're stopping. I would never do that because I want it to work enough that I've been able to play it before I have somebody else play it. And if things aren't working, then I can say, okay, we're going to change that rule. I try not to do that, but every once in a while I will. But you do it however you want. To me, people who are playtesting are doing you a favor, and what they want to do is they want to play a game and have fun, So at that point, you ought to have a game that's that they're going to enjoy. Some games are harder to solitaire play than others. If there's hidden information, it can get pretty tough. The last solitaire game I played, I think I had 8 players, and I was trying to play all 8 players, which takes a bit of thought, but it's much better than dragging 8 people in and then playing a game that's not ready for other people to play. Now, how many times would you solo play test a game? Well, it depends. Surprise. It depends partly on how experienced you are. It depends partly on how good an idea you had. The least I've ever played solo was 1.5 games. And that's turned out to be one of my best games. So I guess I just had a really good idea. The most is 12 times, and that game is in abeyance. I've had other people play it, and I've had to modify it some, and someday we'll play it again and see if the modifications have sorted out the problems. So it worked okay for me, but I was more tolerant of things than other people, because I'm an old-fashioned gamer, and it doesn't bother me certain things that bother younger people that they won't deal with. People want things to be easy. And that's why you play test, so you find out what people think, because you're not your audience. You're unusual if you're a game designer. You're nuts, actually. But you're definitely unusual. And also, you're so close to your game, you really can't separate yourself from it. So you want to see what other people do. So the solo playtest can take quite a while, or it can be real quick. I have games that I've been working on for years. I have the most recent game. And this tells you the strange things that happen. I buy lots and lots of pieces from educational companies and things like that online, EAI online. So I have stacks and stacks of pieces all over the place. And I bought some stackable pieces, 10 colors. And I had some sitting on my coffee table. My wife was sitting there, and one day I said, you know, I ought to design a game with these pieces. And we talked a little while, and she suggested an asteroids theme of some sort, when I said, well, I've got these abstract games. This is going to be an abstract game, and I've already got ones with hexes and ones with other kinds of boards. I want a different kind of board. She suggested asteroids. So I went to a game I did 25 years ago that I have a board of that's concentric circles. Got it out. Okay, here's the concentric circles of the orbits. And the next day, played the game twice. The following Friday, other people were playing it. That's record fast. And then the next day I wrote the rules. That's ridiculous, but that's what happened. And it's pretty good. And then some of the people who played said, you need a war game version of this, because it wasn't a war game, really. And so I made a war game version, which actually I had played solo more than the original one, because it's not working as well. And have I had other people play that? I may not have had other people play that one yet. And I don't have complete rules for that version. So that game came from a set of pieces, and that's not the first time I've done that. So ideas can and impetus can come from all over the place. It can come from some remark somebody makes. The solo playtesting may take months, especially if it's a long game. This is a short game that I'm talking about. If it's a long game, then every time you play test it, it's a long, drawn-out affair, and it's just going to take longer. And you also have games that are symmetric and asymmetric. A symmetric game is one in which all players start equally. That's much easier to get a game balance for than one where players start unequally. Typically, a historical game, the players will start unequally, and in a non-historical game, they'll start equally. But it varies. There's more character in an asymmetric game. A two-player game that's symmetric can be quite tedious, although checkers and go and almost chess are symmetric. At some point then, well, you may or may not write the rules. You probably have notes about the rules that you can organize, and I typically have these notes in InfoSelect, and I'll mark in it with a color the ones that are the actual rule notes. They're not written as formal rules, they're written so I understand them. And I can print those out and then go somewhere and teach people to play the game, because nobody wants to read the rules anyway. And then I can mark on the notes questions that I haven't covered as they play the game. After that happens, then usually I'm ready to write a full set of rules. Writing a full set of rules is really a pain in the butt, because it's hard to get them so that everybody understands it equally. In fact, it's impossible. But you want to get it so that 99.9% of the people understand it, or 99% of the people understand it one way, and the other 1% have got weird ideas that go all over the place. That's about the best you can do. The English is a clumsy language. All languages are clumsy. So, writing the rules is hard, and you have to keep revising them. And I know sometimes I save with a different number, and on one of my best games where the rules were relatively easy, I'm up to number 15. And I don't always assign a new number when I modify it. Writing the rules in a board game or card game is like doing the programming in a video game, very much. If the programming doesn't work, then the game doesn't work. If the rules aren't good, then the game doesn't work. The difference is, you can play a prototype of a non-digital game with a not full set of rules as long as you've got the person who designed the game. You can't do that with a video game. If the programming isn't finished and right, then it's not going to work. This is one of the reasons why video game design books tend to talk so much about upfront plan everything out, because programming is very expensive and very time consuming, and you've got to try to figure out everything to sell some publisher on the game so that they'll pay you to develop the game. That's the way it tends to work in video games. So, at some point you'll have a full set of rules, probably after other people have played the game some. But that varies again. The simpler the game, the easier it is to write the rules, fairly obviously. If you're doing a game with 24 pages of rules, that's a lot more of a pain than if you do a game with 4 pages of rules. And one of the things I do is do word counts and put them at the bottom of the rules so I know what kind of word counts I've got, and I can tell publishers what the word count is, because that gives you some idea of the complexity of the game. There are lots of different ways to write rules. Nonetheless, the longer they are, the more complex it's going to be, other things being equal. And the rules are really important. You've probably all played games where you couldn't figure out what the rules said, and you tried to play it some way, and apparently it wasn't the right way, and it was a dud. Just as those of us who've played digital games have got ones that didn't work very well and crashed, and you needed to patch before you could fix it. And you want to get that right. And the publisher may try to help you get that right. It depends on the publisher. The publisher will assign a developer, and the developer may help get that right. But you can't rely on that. To me, you want to get it right yourself. But there are different strokes for different folks. There's one designer who has a lot of games published by GMT who clearly does not test much and relies on the developer. And I've been told that's exactly the case. But I could figure that out from looking at the games. If he gets a good developer, then he may end up with a good game. If he doesn't, then he may end up with not so good a game. But he spends a lot less time. It's kind of an 80-20 situation. The design of the game is 20% of your time, and developing it, once you've got it to where other people are playing it and so on, is 80% of the time. Because it takes a long time to play the games and so on. You have to decide what you want to do. To me, if I supply a game that's complete, it's less likely to be screwed up. And the manufacturer is more likely to look at my other games because they know they don't have to do as much work. Developers have to be paid. The more work the developer does, the more work they're probably paid. So, number 7, which is essentially the last step here, is play test by others and blind test. Blind testing is when you send the game somewhere and you're not there and they have to figure it out and play it. Typically when you have others play test it, you will be there. Will you play? Well, I don't. I try not to. Because, as I said, the designer's in a game. Let's gang up on him. The designer's in a game. He's going to win. It skews the game one way or the other. And I cannot concentrate on the game to play it and concentrate on how the game is going for everybody else at the same time. So I screw both those up. So I'd rather not play. But there are other people who would rather play.
When you're play testing, do you do it towards your target audience or do you do a random selection of people?
The trick is to find play testers, period.
Yeah.
And if you live in a really big metropolitan area or where there are a lot of people, then you're fortunate. And I don't live in such a big metropolitan area. Many of the people who have play tested my games have been video gamers who did not play board games. Well, that's a good testing audience, because if they can enjoy the game, then maybe you got something. Many others, there's a monthly game night about 70 miles from where I live that I go to, and those people are generally Euro gamers. And, you know, I'm not very good at roping people into playing, but I try. And the guy who runs it, he helps out sometimes. So sometimes they play a lot and sometimes they don't. And I get to watch the Euro games, and that's my way of figuring out what people like in Euro games. So it all works out. But there again, if the Euro players like the games, then there's probably something there, if they can tolerate various things. On the other hand, if I have games like Britannia that I want to play test, I don't have anybody to play test them. Or not enough. You know, you need four. And I can tend to get three together. So that varies over time. You know, people move away, you meet more people. Reiner Knizia, I'm told, playtests six nights a week. And of course, he can find the testers because he's so well known.
Do you ever recruit your students for playtesting?
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, no extra credit. No, never. I tell them, you're not getting any brownie points out of this. This is just something if you want to do it, okay. Never. That would not be right.
Do you ever find that they have trouble criticizing your games too harshly when you're grading them in other classes?
I don't think it comes into it, actually. People tend to be nice. The trick is to get them to say something bad.
Yeah.
But that's more of the blind test, though, doesn't it? I mean,
yeah, the blind test can. I have people, you know, I have some player testers who are very reliable and they know me very well, they're friends of mine, and they'll be happy to say, Lou, you suck. One of them is a former software tester and his job was to break the software, so he's happy when he can break the game. Ha ha ha, I made Lou write something down. And that's cool. So that's, I'm lucky in those two guys, very lucky. And one of them, the other one, he's a brilliant programmer and also is amazingly good at spotting the right strategy. And he can spot strategy sometimes even I haven't spotted, and I used to be a really good player. So that's good, because you don't want to have a game that you put out there and then somebody finds a strategy nobody thought of and it changes the game. It's going to happen. I was talking to a GMT and they were talking about card-driven games. And they said, you know, we get 40, 50 people to play test it, and that's really good. But as soon as it goes out, 3,000 people are playing it, and they're going to find things that we didn't find. And then we're going to have to change the rules. And that's one reason why they have living rules. Now, living rules, you don't want to have to deal with, because people have to go online and get the rules and so on, but sometimes it's inevitable. Sometimes it's unavoidable. Depends on how complex the game is. It's kind of like a patch on a PC game. Well, console games, you can't patch. So they've got to be very careful about console games, but they do get some duds that don't work very well, and then they're duds. With PC games, they can be fixed. They aren't always fixed, but they can be fixed. I have taken lately to trying to do the six hats with my playtesters. And that's an idea developed by Edward de Bono, who's in English, I believe. And it was developed for evaluating ideas. But you have different colored hats, and you ask people to assume a particular hat. And one hat will be, what are the risks involved in this? Another hat will be, what are the good points of this? Another hat will be, what are the bad points of this? And by asking them to assume these hats, they're a little more likely to actually say something. But I don't, you know, some designers will have little questionnaires that they'll give to people. I don't do that. Maybe I feel it's too time consuming for the person. I don't know. It is a difficult problem that people are basically nice, and so they won't say bad things about it. I try to watch the people as they play, and as I said, I try not to play, and see if it appears that they find something tedious, or they're having difficulty grasping something, and then that's what I'll work on, and see whether they enjoy the game as best I can tell. In the end, games are kind of funny, because nowadays, and at this particular meeting that I go to especially, people only play a game once, and they'll play something else, no matter what. Sometimes I'll play the same game again and again over the course of 2 years I've been there. Even that, they play Robo Rally a lot, but that's because the guy who's the host, it's his favorite game. So, yeah, they're going to play Robo Rally a lot, because he gets people to play Robo Rally. But it is always a problem to try to figure out how the game is going, and you just have to watch carefully and listen and body language and things like that. And then if you want to, you try something like the six hats and see what people say. And some people are better playtesters than others. They're just more likely to make comments and suggestions. The more you can get, the better. At some point, you have to finish the rules, and you see that playtesters are outside the thing because you're getting playtester input as they playtest the game. And you have a final version, quote-unquote, you store it somewhere, and then you submit to a publisher. You submit a proposal to a publisher, they say, yeah, I want to see the game, you submit the game. And then you wait a couple years, probably, before it's published, if it is published. It takes quite a while. Now, each of those circles could have another diagram like this below it, and I've started working on that, but I haven't got it. That'll be posted on my website and on Board Game Geek when I get there. The one thing we can say about all this is you need to do it. You can talk all your life about designing games and get all kinds of ideas. You need to do it. You need to get to where you have a prototype and you're playing that prototype. And then you need to write the rules at some point. You need to finish a game. Because until you finish the game, you can't submit a game. And so many people don't get there. And maybe if they did, they would be successful, but they never get there. Now, what are some of the other things you can do here? As I've talked about, you can put yourself in the player's shoes. And you can do that in number two, the mind's eye playing. But you can also think about it when the people are actually playing the game. What is this person now thinking about? What problems does this person see? What choices does this person have? Some games give lots and lots of choices, and some people don't like that. They don't want to be overwhelmed with choices. They get analysis paralysis, they call it. They want a few choices, and that tends to be a characteristic of Euro games, that the players have a few reasonable choices. And at some time in a game, one choice might be good, sometime another. They're all plausible at certain times in the game. This is as opposed to the old style Hex War games where you move all the pieces at once. That's a lot of decisions. That's not Euro at all. That's not modern. Is it worse or better? No, it's just different. But if you recognize that you're trying to produce a game that will be successful and it will sell to people, then you've got to look at what the modern points of view are, not at the points of view of people my age. Now, if you're going to some of these companies that print 1,500 copies of a game, then you can look at people my age, because there are a lot of people my age still who will buy historical games that are very fiddly and very large, and they're happy with that. You can do that, but you'll have a smaller market. Always keep in mind, what can the player do? What is the player feeling? What is the player doing that might not be fun? Record keeping might not be fun. A lot of games nowadays that 25 years ago you would have written something down, you now have a display where you put a piece somewhere to keep track of things. Well, then you don't have to write anything down. It's easier and you can see it. So that's an improvement. But it's more expensive because you've got to have the pieces and you've got to have that piece of paper or that cardboard. But generally people don't want to do record keeping. I'm going to tell this story even though I told it, many of you have heard it. When Britannia was revised and published, the manufacturer decided not to include the score sheet that everybody had used for 25 years. Presumably, they felt that people should not be required to write something down. They were going to put a scoring track on, and the score can go up to 200, to over 200. And I said, no, scoring track, bad idea. This is a 4 or 5 hour game. Somebody's going to knock it off and lose. No, don't do that. Well, they said, yeah, you're right. So they included a bunch of little round pieces with points on them, and you get points, you get those pieces as you go along. So people did not have to keep records. Now, most of them, once they get the scoring sheets from online somewhere, they'll use a scoring sheet because it's less fiddly. But not everybody. They have an option. So the manufacturer felt that was important. I would never have thought of it. Because you don't have to write down that many things that often. But that's the way they felt. Let's see. There was a French engineer and a early pilot whose name I cannot pronounce. He also wrote Little Women, of all things. And he had a saying that an engineer knows when he is done, not when there is nothing to add, but when there is nothing to take away. And that's the way games go these days, that you want to take away as much as you can and still have a good game. Reduce it to the simplest thing, because otherwise people won't want to play. We were talking about educational games, and one of the problems is that the teachers do not want to learn the game rules. Fair enough. Most of them are not gamers. You know, in most game groups, there is an alpha gamer who learns the games and teaches the other people. Or maybe two or three, depending, you know. Somebody buys a game, they learn the rules, they teach everybody else. Well, if the teacher's not willing to do that, how are you going to play the game in the classroom? Well, I said, you know, you can use relatively simple techniques. Recording like I'm recording now on an MP3 player or through headphones on a computer, and record an audio track and then put photographs together to make a movie and show people that about how to play the game. If it's a simple enough game, then they don't have to read the rules. It's like somebody's teaching them the game. That is an option that we have in normal gaming, but it's probably necessary to get games into education, to provide this easier way of learning, because people will not read the rules. You know, I've had playtesters who were happily played simple games, 2.5 pages of rules. One time I just tried to give them the rules to see what would happen. They just gave up. That's the way it is. You know, anybody here who's a teacher knows students don't read textbooks anymore. You give students a book and they say, what do I ever do with that? You know, do I hit somebody with it? They don't know what to do. Or they don't want to do anything. They don't want to read. Not in a book. They might read online. Even there, they might not. They want to be told. They want to hear. They want to see. Well, depending on your market, you may have to cope with that. It's not the case that manufacturers will include that with their games usually, but some, like Days of Wonder, will put flash things that show how to play their games online and spend the money to have that produced, flash movies. And of course, once you do that, you can put it on YouTube and maybe you'll get lucky and a few people look at it and they'll buy the game as well. Who knows? So, you're trying to simplify things for people, whether you like it, whether you think it's manly that they won't read the rules? You've got to recognize that a lot of them won't do it. Or if they do it, they'll do it so badly that they won't play the game right. That's very common. You give teenagers something to read, and when they get done, it's like they're illiterate. They're not illiterate. They just haven't bothered to read it all. And so they don't know what it says. They can read the words perfectly well. They just don't bother. Well, if that happens with your game, then they're not going to play it right. Fortunately, if they have a game and they bought the game, they probably have an incentive to read the rules. Still, we have to recognize that these things are happening and how things change. Okay. Let's see. I've talked about the stages of completion of games. Let's see. Design versus development. Development has one meaning in the computer game industry. It means writing the programming and all that. But development in the non-computer game industry means you as a designer get done, and then the game is given to somebody else by the manufacturer, and they try to figure out what they think about the game. If you're lucky, you'll get a manufacturer like GMT who says, we won't change the game without your permission. If you're unlucky, you'll get a manufacturer who'll change it however they want, publish it. That happens. They think they know better. Maybe they do. Who knows? My experience has not been good. When they change things, it usually is for the worse. All right, now, the fundamental structures of any game, I'm going to talk about 9 things that go into any game. Not a sports game. We're talking board games, card games, not sports. And these are all in the slides. The first thing you're going to have in some form, even if you decide not to have it, you still made a decision, is a theme or a history or a story. Even games that don't appear to have a story, there's some story, a little bit to it. Other than abstract games. Abstract games have no story. Abstract games have no theme. There are lots of Euro games that are abstract, but a theme has been tacked on. There are many other games where the theme changes how the game works. That's the way I always do things, but not everybody does it that way. Games are usually models of reality. Well, what reality are we referring to? That's where the theme comes from. But once again, there are many Euro games that have no relation to reality. And that's, some people like that. How many people here have played Winky? Or Winky is a proper pronunciation. Vinci is what most people say. Vinci. Yeah, Vinci. It's pronounced Winky. It's Latin. That game, which theoretically is about the rise and fall of empires, has absolutely nothing to do with reality. It's a map of Europe, but you'd never know it unless you look at it carefully. But Euro gamers like that. I think if you put more history into it, it would put some people off. Who knows? It's a game that's been around a long time and is out of print. Let's see. So, theme, history, story. There may be a model of reality, but who knows what reality. Games have objectives or victory conditions. If they don't have an objective or a victory condition, is it a game? I don't think so. I think it's a toy. Now, you can argue about these things, forever. How many people here have ever played Katamari Damacy? It's this brilliant game, PlayStation, where you have a ball, and as you roll the ball, things stick to it. And it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. People stick to it. And when it gets big enough, trees stick to it. When it gets big enough, buildings stick to it. That's all there is. People love to play it. I've watched students play it. I've not played it. Because I'd get bored. But they don't get bored. And it can be pretty funny. To me, that's a toy. But I've known people who argued, well, they set a time limit, and so it's a game. Well, the time limit is purely arbitrary. And you're not playing against anybody. There's no opposition. You just have to figure out how to maneuver. That's a toy to me. A game has some objective or victory condition that says you have won this game, or you have failed to do this, you have lost this game.
You have to reach a certain size before the time limit's over.
Yeah.
And there's
yeah.
two-player competitive
version
as well.
Which is a game.
Well, then, if you played 2 players, it would be a game.
Well, unless it's dexterity, primarily in which case it's a sport.
You could call it that, yes. But you can argue at great length about games, puzzles, and toys. But I'm going to say that I think a game has an objective or a victory condition. Even a cooperative game, there's a victory condition. You may all win, but there's still a victory condition because you can all lose as well. There's got to be some way to lose or win in a game. And you have to decide what that is. And that can be very important. Typically, a Euro game has point objectives, and there are several ways to get points. Typically, with the older war games, you had a territorial objective. And that affects how the game goes to a great extent. The next one is data storage or information management. And I'm not talking computers here. How do we represent or model the state of affairs? Often we have a board, and we have pieces. But you can use cards. You can lay cards out and have them in the shape of a board. I have several card games where the cards are the board. There are different ways to do this. So you can just assume you're doing a board and you're going to do certain things, but that's not always the case. But you have to, there's a decision there, or at least a default that, oh yeah, I'm going to do a board because how else would I do it? Well, there are other ways to do it. Data storage or information management. Going back to record keeping, we don't want to make people write things down, but so many of these Euro games like Puerto Rico and so on have these sheets where you're keeping track of a bunch of things and you have bunches of bits. What always surprises me about Euro games is they're supposed to be simple, and yet some of them have vast numbers of little bits, which doesn't look simple to me at all, but it doesn't seem to mind people. Sequencing is the next thing. What is the sequence of play? It doesn't have to be turn-based. There are real-time games, especially card games. James Ernest likes to design them. Snap is a simple real-time card game from England. When you can play, you play. So it's not necessarily the case that it was 30 years ago where one side moves all its pieces and does its stuff, then the other side moves all its pieces and does its stuff, even though that's still the most common thing. Especially in two-player games. One of the things I've tried to do in my games that I've aimed at a Euro market is make it so you're not sure what the sequence is from turn to turn. There are various ways to do that. One way is I have people play cards that do certain things, and those cards have initiatives. So one turn they may play a card with a good initiative, and they'll be the first to move of everybody. The next turn they may play a card with a bad initiative, but they'll be last to move of everybody. But they know what the initiatives are, they know what they're looking for, they know what they're asking for. Another way is there's something like victory points or fame or something like that that determines who moves first. And that can change over time, and so who moves first changes over time. So you're not stuck in turn-based. But even turn-based, there's turn-based, move one piece, chess, turn-based, move a few pieces, turn-based, move all the pieces. What are you going to do? You're deciding that in some way or other, whether you know it or not. You may have a default. You may just assume it's going to be a particular way, but you have made a decision. I would rather that you make a conscious decision than to just make an assumption. Because you as the designer are trying to control what happens. It's like designing a game is a game in itself. You want to control everything and make sure it comes out right. Number five, movement or placement. And we're assuming people have pieces, but this could be cards. What are the players doing with the objects of the game? That's a decision that has to be made. I'm going to give some examples here in a bit about different games and specify some of these things, but you have to decide how the objects are translated from one place to another. That's another way to put it. Information availability is an obvious one. Is all the information available? Is there a fog of war? Is there uncertainty? Dice are an obvious way to introduce uncertainty. But a lot of people don't like dice nowadays, and so you get lots of games that don't have dice in them anymore. But a lot of them have cards, and the cards are uncertain. But sometimes you have hidden pieces. Who knows? You have to decide. Traditional games, all the information is available. But we've gone beyond traditional games. 7, conflict resolution or interaction of game entities. Is there any conflict at all? Is there shooting? Is there swordplay? Is there spells? Is there jumping? There's all kinds of things you can have. What are you going to do there? Number 8 is economy or resource acquisition. How do people get more stuff to use in the game? Some games don't have that. There is no way to get more stuff. But many games do. In some games, that's closer to reality. One of the things I don't like about Winky or Vinci is that you get some pieces for an empire and then you never get any more. How terribly unrealistic. But it doesn't bother the people who play. Money in Monopoly. In Monopoly, you get money. That's a way to acquire more stuff. In checkers, you can king people. In chess, you can promote people. In Go, I don't believe there's a way to get more pieces. You've got an unlimited supply. In tic-tac-toe, you've got an unlimited supply. It might be, and so in something like Britannia, you count up your territories and that determines how many more armies you can get. That's fairly typical in a war game. Number 9, the last thing is, what rules are there for player interaction? Direct interaction between players. In a lot of games, there aren't any. There's no direct interaction between players in chess or checkers. They can talk, there's a psychological thing going on there, but there's no rules for it. But think about negotiation games or trading games or auction games. There's lots of interaction between the players. And players tend to like this. Are you going to put interaction into the game or not? It takes time. Can you afford the time? One of the things I've done in Britannia, for example, is I say in the rules, yes, you can negotiate, but you can't leave the table and negotiate secretly because it'd take too long. And the players are going to negotiate anyway. Even if you say don't negotiate, they'll start talking about the situation in the board in order to try to influence somebody else. So it's going to happen anyway. You might as well not try to prevent that. That would be tedious. So that's a very brief explanation of those structures. There can be much longer explanations. And if I ever write the book that I've been talking about, I will go into greater detail about these things. Now, where did I put those sheets I was going to pass around?
Can you list all nine again?
Pardon?
Can you list all the nine elements again?
Okay, let's see if I can do two things at once. I can. Number 1 was theme, history, or story. Number 2 was objective or victory conditions. Same thing. Number 3, data storage or information management. How do you keep track of things? Number 4 is sequencing. Number 5, movement and placement of pieces. Number 6, information availability. Number 7, conflict resolution or interaction of game entities. And there might not be conflict, but that's a choice you make. Number 8 was economy, resource acquisition. And number 9 was player interaction rules. Are there any? What are they? Is he telling you to go take a hike? Why would he do that to such a nice lady? All right, tic-tac-toe. Let's take some examples of games. Is there a theme in tic-tac-toe? I think you'd have to call it an abstract game. So there isn't one. Victory, 3 in a row. And you can have a draw. A lot of games you can't have a draw. What's the data storage? The 3x3 array of squares. Very simple. I mean, tic-tac-toe is about as simple as you can get. Sequencing, you take turns placing one piece, but you take turns. Movement. You can't move pieces, but you can place one from off the board on the board. That's your movement. Information, all the information is available. Conflict. Well, you can't occupy a square that's occupied by the other player's piece. So you have to place it somewhere else. Economy. You have unlimited pieces. That's not a problem. And there's no player interaction rules of any kind. So it's a very simple game. All right, let's take Pac-Man, the video game. Story. Well, there's not much of a story there. First video game to have characters, but there's not much of a story. Victory. You get through all the levels. You can get through all the levels and finish. What's the storage? Well, it looks to me like there's a square array in the computer and you're moving on those squares. You don't see the squares, but I think they're there. The sequencing. Well, simultaneous movement, or at least it appears to be simultaneous. In a computer, nothing's ever simultaneous. Of course, it's time slicing. Well, nowadays we have multiple processors, but with the old time slicing stuff, things actually happened in a sequence, but it acted as though it was simultaneous. Simultaneous movement is fairly hard to pull off in board games. Movement, your piece moves to an adjacent square. In effect, that's what's happening in Pac-Man. You might not think of it that way, but that's what's happening. All the information is available. You can see everything that there is to see. Conflict depends on timing. You know, sometimes the Pac-Man can touch the monsters and kill them, and sometimes the monsters can kill Pac-Man. I don't know the exact rules. I never actually played Pac-Man. I think I played it on an Atari, actually. Economy. You can earn additional lives. So you can acquire more capability, at least in additional lives. And there's also a way to acquire that death touch so that Pac-Man can kill the monsters. I don't remember what it is, but it's there. You're earning points that it ends up giving you additional capabilities. And player interaction, of course, you're playing against a computer, so there's no special interaction rules there. Okay, chess. Chess, the theme is abstract, but it used to represent warfare. At least so people say. I'm a little skeptical. Victory. Checkmate the opposing king can be a draw. Chess is unusual. If you're about to win, you have to warn the other player. That's what check is. How many games are like that? Very few. Storage, the 8x8 array. Again, traditional games are going to have simple storages. Sequencing, you take your turns moving one piece. Take turns, move one piece. Movement, you have to move one piece at a time. The movement capability varies, and so the different pieces can move in different ways. You also have castling, you also have promotion, so there's some unusual moves there. All the information is available. There's no hidden information. Conflict is very simple. You occupy an opponent's square, you wipe out the opponent. It doesn't matter if you're the pawn and it's the queen. Economy, the only way to get new pieces is promotion. Get your pawn to the end. And there's no special rules for player interaction, as is typical of a traditional game. Okay, now, Doom, the video version. Theme. Mayhem seems to be the theme, and the only theme in Doom. What are you trying to do? You survive and reach some kind of goal. You get through all the levels again. Storage, some kind of array in the computer, and I don't know what it is. It's not obvious anymore. But there's got to be some kind of array in the computer to keep track of where things are. Sequence seems to be real time. Movement, you move more or less as a person would. You go forward, you turn sideways, and so on. There's lots of uncertainty, lots of fog of war. You don't know where the monsters are. Sometimes you can hear them but not see them, which is very easy to do in a computer game and pretty hard to do in a non-computer game. Conflict, you have shooting, you have lots of different kinds of guns, a BFG, and all that good stuff. And you can also have melee, so that's fairly complicated. Economy, you can earn additional lives, you can pick up health, and those sorts of things. There's a lot of that there. And again, there's no player interaction, as is typical in a computer game. Let's see. Axis and allies. looking to see how much more I have to talk about here. Okay, we can do this. How many people here have played Axis and Allies? I played the computer version. I never played the other version. What's the theme? World War II, worldwide. Victory, take and hold the enemy capitals. Simple victory condition. Storage, it's a map with areas on it, which is fairly common for board games. Sequencing, you take turns, very common. Movement, you move all your pieces each turn. You have limitations as to what can move on the land, what can move on the sea, what can move on the air. There's a lot of movement rules in Axis and Allies. All the information is known, there's no hidden pieces and so on. There is some uncertainty, as I recall, about if you want to do research, something like that. Research to get new capabilities.
Combat die rolls too.
Yep. In combat there's die rolls that are causing uncertainty. Conflict, you move in the enemy area and you roll the dice, and there are lots of different details there as well. Economy, you use industrial points to purchase new units and technology. A more complicated game, still no special player interaction rules, which is, again, typical, unless you get into some of the Euro games of trading and auctions and so on. Civilization 3, how many people ever played Civilization on the computer? Not too many. The theme is the growth of civilization through the ages, more or less historical, pretty big theme. Victory, there are different ways to do it. You can reach the stars, you can have conquest, there are other means as well. So there are multiple ways to win. Again, we have a square array in the computer. It's really just squares. Sequencing is turn-based again, and you can move all your pieces, very old-fashioned. You do all your actions in your turn, and then the next player does all their actions, and so on. One of the things that causes is downtime, and downtime is frowned upon because people are easily bored nowadays, so they don't want to be waiting a long time, mostly. I think Andrew Looney says he likes to have downtime so he can go do something else. But he's a little strange, you know. Looney is, I understand he is Looney. Haven't met him. Let's see. There's lots of fog and war and lots of uncertainty in civilization. Lots. Conflict, you enter the enemy's unit square, and there's rules for firing and technology, so on and so forth. Economy, very complex resource management, pollution, taxes. We're getting a much more complicated game. And in player action, there are actual diplomacy rules for making alliances and so on. So this is a game that has player interaction rules, in effect. Okay, the last one I'm going to talk about here is Britannia. What's the theme? The history of Britain, 44 AD to 1085 AD. Victory. You accumulate more points than anyone else. You score in a variety of ways, mostly occupying territory, sometimes killing enemy units, and so on. The storage. There's a board with 37 land areas and 5 seas. Sequencing is turn-based by nation, not by player. So you might control 3 nations. And one will move early in the game, one in the middle, and one late in the turn. So that's a bit unusual. Movement, you can move all your pieces when it's your nation's turn. You do all your actions. Most of the pieces can move 2 areas. And there are limitations. You can't go back to sea and so on. All the information is available. No fog of war. Now, if you play the version where people are using the little counters to keep the score and people are not keeping score separately, then you're not sure how many points everybody has. Economy, you can increase your forces based on the reinforcement lists, and also if you control areas, you can then generate more pieces, agriculture. And player interaction, negotiation is only allowed at the table. So, you can do this with any game. And, you know, I won't swear that there's only these 9 structures, but I think it works pretty well. And it gives you something to hang your hat on. If you're thinking about designing a game and you say at some point, okay, what's the theme? What's the economy? What's this? What's that? Then that's going to help you decide what you're going to do. You may change your mind later, but it's going to help you decide. And what novices are missing is a framework for how to decide what to do. They're sort of floating in the air. Well, what do I do? And that's especially true for video game people because the books are like that. I have, and it's on my website, and it may be posted somewhere on Board Game Geek, I've tried to reduce to one page what's important in designing a game. I find this to be a really good exercise. One page, what's important about something. Because it makes you decide what's really important. And it makes you describe it succinctly. So, I'll read you what I've got here. Know your audience. What do they like? No game can satisfy all tastes. Know your objectives. What are you trying to achieve? Design is 10% inspiration and 90% perspiration. Writing usable rules or doing the programming is the hardest part for most people. Write everything down and back it up. Playtesting is sovereign, quote unquote. No matter what you think about how the game will work, only efficient playtesting will actually show how it works. Without a playable prototype, you have nothing, quote unquote. Ideas are cheap, easy. A playable game is much harder to create. Players must be able to influence the outcome of the game by their choices amongst non-obvious alternatives. Otherwise, it's not a game. Maybe a puzzle or a toy. Be willing to change the game again and again. Because if you don't, the manufacturer will. Hardly any idea is original, but ideas can be used in new ways. And there's almost always a new way to treat any subject. For example, Monopoly is a real estate game. There's a lot of different ways to do a real estate game. Monopoly is only one. Games are supposed to be fun, but fun means different things to different people. Whatever you think is fun, a lot of people think something else. Keep in mind the 9 fundamental structures of games, which we just talked about. The road to the complete game, ideas, playable ideas, prototypes, play solo, play test, fully written rules, keep experimenting, blind test. Now, I'll give you, let's see. Okay, we're doing very well here. Another example of a game I designed, and this is another strange thing. I like those little glass-colored beads. They're not very practical for games because they add a lot of weight and that adds to the shipping, so don't make a game that uses a lot of them. But I did. But, you know, the manufacturer can do what they want. I wanted to have a game that used those little beads. Well, there's no differentiation. In fact, you can get bigger sizes, and I've got them. I buy pounds of the things. But one size of bead. I wanted a game. I didn't want to use dice or anything. But I had to introduce some kind of uncertainty because a game with one kind of piece isn't going to get very far. Okay, Go does, but we're not going to try to reproduce Go. So I thought, how can we get some uncertainty in here that's not dice? How many people here have ever played Flux? Well, I never played, but I watched people play. Actually, I may have played. I don't remember. I said, well, the key to Flux is the rules change. So I want the rules to change in this game. So I have cards in the game that tell you how you win and how you can do a capture. The board is very simple. The board is just a hexagonal array. I think I have the board in here. It's an abstract game. And I have cards that have capture methods, and I have cards that have victory methods. And each player has one of each in front of him, and then there's one of each that affects everybody. So everybody has 2 ways to win, 2 ways to capture. They have a hand of cards that includes some of those cards, and also cards that do things like make somebody lose a turn or block when somebody wants to change things. So they can play a card, which often involves changing somebody else's capture method, or changing their own, or changing the victory method, or changing their own. And they play the game. And it turned out to be a perfect 3-player game, which is very, very rare. Because two players can usually, but not always, gang up on the one who appears to be close to winning. With two players, it just tends to steamroll. One guy gets ahead and it goes away. So people are placing their pieces on the board. They don't move, they just place. When I originally designed it, I had an option to move, but it wasn't done much, so I took it out. They place their pieces to try to form patterns, because you win by forming a pattern. The edge of the world, score with four in an orthogonal row on the edge of the board. And you have to watch what the other people are doing. So that arose from wanting to use those pieces and thinking, let's introduce changes like flux. Now, I've not submitted this to anybody yet. I'm told by people who I think know that it will be my most viable game commercially because it has some Euro aspects. Many, many people have played it, and it seems to be very good. I think, well, that's not bad. It's not my sort of game. It's not a Lou game. But I like it all right. So by setting that limit in effect, which is I want to make a game with these pieces, but I need to have some variation, I have no overt chance element. Obviously, you can get good cards or bad cards. And the game is called Law and Chaos, and there's two versions. Another version, the lawful version, you don't get a hand of cards. You can take a card off the pile and then play it if you want. So then the positions become more important. And then you can play with four and it works out. Otherwise, four tends to never end. Games can start in a lot of different ways. That's the point of that. Now, these slides have books about game design. They have some web resources. And I recommend you download the slides and then you can find out what those books are and what those resources are. And by Jove, it's just time to be done. Any questions? I mean, I'll stick around for a while.
So I just have a few questions. One, what are the six hats? You gave us the, what are the risks? What's the good part? What's the bad part? What are the other three?
Oh.
Of play testing?
I don't remember. Okay. I have it written down, and I don't think I brought it with me.
Right.
If you look up six hats online, you'll run into Edward DeBono's stuff. He's written a number of books and is very well known. I may have it posted somewhere on my website. I don't know. I wouldn't bet on it. Pardon?
How many games have you designed?
You mean that were published or just were designed?
Published.
It depends on how you count. Swords and Wizardry was the first one. Diplomacy, Games, and Variants is a booklet that has maps. It's all variants of diplomacy. Valley of the Four Winds, these are published in England. Dragon Rage, which was published in Texas, 1982. Britannia in 1986 in England, 1987 in America, 1990 or thereabouts in Germany, and in the revised version, 2006. So they had a big gap there where I was not involved in the game industry at all. I played Dungeons & Dragons and didn't do anything else. I never read the rules to the published version of Britannia until 2004. I never saw it played until 2004. So I'm weird. And I watched it and I said, no way! Because they had somebody hanging out in the ocean centuries after they should have gone away. That was one of the changes that got made. And I didn't know about it until I watched somebody play. And I fixed it, damn it. I'm not very good at it, I have to admit. I have a playtest listserv, and I try to get people to playtest things, but what I don't do is follow up very well, because the typical thing is you send the people the game and then you don't hear from them. And I'm just not very good at it. So that's a problem that I have.
Are you looking for people to do the blind playtest for you?
Sure.
Actively send you back feedback.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because I have... Fortunately, my nephew, who is English, is very good at it. But, you know, Uncle Lou goes over to England like once a year or once every 2 years, and then he and niece and I play games all the time, and everybody else is wondering what the hell we're doing. which is really strange because I'm not a kid person at all. I don't have children, and that's deliberate. But I get along fine with them, and they're happy to play games, so it works out for everybody. And sometimes their cousin comes and plays games, and so I get feedback occasionally. That's good.
Okay.
If you go to pulseforgames.com, and the playtest listserv is on there. It may be on that sheet. I don't know. It may be on that sheet.
How profitable is game design?
See, he didn't come to one. He didn't come the first one, did he? There are a few people who make their living at it. I officially lose money at it every year. Because once you count in things like coming to these conventions and buying all these pieces and so on and so forth, by Jove, it adds up. So, no, you're not going to, unless you're very unusual, you're not going to make a lot of money. But Matt Forbeck supports a family of seven. He does it full time. It's a hobby to me.
Video game design.
Video game design, you're usually working for the company. The trouble is, if the company doesn't come up with a new deal by the time your previous game gets done, you get laid off. And I know a guy who's had 6 or 7 games published, video games, and he finally got tired of getting laid off. And so he went into academia. It really is a chancy thing. There's some companies like Red Storm in the Triangle down in North Carolina. They do so well at those Clancy games, you know, Rainbow Six and so on, they just keep doing them. So they've got pretty steady jobs, at least for now. Anything else? Uh-huh.
Off topic, kind of. Britannia, do you prefer this, I've got it, the Fantasy Flight version, do you prefer hidden victory points or the open?
Well, you know, there's arguments about that on Board Game Geek, and it's what's called trackable stuff. If I'm trying to win a game and it's trackable, I'm going to track it. So there's no such thing as hidden victory points.
So it's just easier for everyone involved. How did you design it? I mean, because it sounds like, you designed it, what do you prefer? I mean, what way to have the rules, how would you write it?
Oh, use a score sheet. Because people can do it anyway. Yes. If everybody has to keep track of the score on their own, it's tedious. So just the hell with it. Write it down on the score sheet.
Okay.
But if people all agree to do it hidden and not keep track, that's their prerogative. That's the advantage of having those counters in there. So that turned out to be a good thing. Cost Fantasy Flight money, but it's a good thing.
You don't know who to bash, though.
Well, yes. But even when you know the score, unless you really have studied the game, you don't know who to bash.
Okay.